Welcome back to the Grizzly Books podcast. My name is Gisela Kay. I'm the host of this podcast and the author of the true crime book series that we discuss here. Now we're on season 4, episode 2, and we're discussing Eileen Wuornos, The Damsel of Death. Obviously, this means that this is the fourth book in my book series. Before that was Jeffrey Dahmer, The Milwaukee Monster, Ted Bundy, The Campus Killer, and John Wayne Gacy, The Killer Clown. If you want to grab yourself a copy of any of those books, just go to grizzly-books.com. I'll link it below for you. And there you can find all the links for whichever format you prefer, whether it's ebooks, paperbacks, or audiobooks. And lastly, before we get started, I just want to mention my merch store, which I've just launched for you guys. There I've got t-shirts that say it like it is. You know, I do not like to romanticize or glorify or sensationalize these serial killers. So for example, one of my t-shirts there is called Nose Picker, and underneath it says Ted Bundy because he was a chronic nose picker. If you didn't know that, maybe you might want to grab a copy of my books. All my books are highly detailed. I try to put all the information I can possibly find into one convenient location, because I don't know about you, whenever I've come across a case, right, and you want to look at it, there is so much information out there. If you just want to find out one thing, for example, what was Eileen Wuornos' last meal? Well, we all would say black coffee, right, because that's what we've been told, but it actually wasn't. And in this book, I cover what it actually was. It also wasn't what Nick Broomfield said on the Eileen Wuornos documentary. You know, he said it was KFC and fries that she had with her friend Dawn Botkins. But it wasn't that either. So, you see, things like that. I like to do the myth-busting thing, find all the details, find the facts, you know, untangle all the webs of lies that we've been fed, and just put it all in one very factual place. So you'll see my writing is quite dry and true crimey, you know, it's supposed to be. I definitely don't put my own opinion in there or fluff or anything like that. It's just pure true crime. So if you're into that kind of thing, I think these books might be for you. Alrighty, so today we're going to be looking at Eileen Wuornos' trial and sentencing. It was quite a mess, so brace yourself. On January 14th, 1992, 1 year after confessing to the murders of 7 men, Eileen Wuornos went to trial in DeLand, Volusia County, Florida, for the murder of 51-year-old Richard Mallory, her first victim, whose body, car, personal belongings, which was a camera and radar detector, and murder weapon had been traced directly to her. She was represented by the Chief Assistant Public Defender of the 5th Judicial Circuit, Tricia Jenkins, and the Assistant Public Defender, Billy Nolis. John Tanner was the state's attorney, and the judge was Uriel, his nickname was Bunky, Blount Jr., who literally came out of retirement just to try her case when another judge had been disqualified from it. Now, I dug and dug and dug, but I could not find why the other judge was disqualified from it. No idea, but there was another judge disqualified from the case, and out of retirement came Judge Uriel Bunky Blount Jr. He had a career that lasted more than 5 decades and had experience in sentencing prolific criminals, including the death sentence of Daniel Morris Thomas, who was the leader of the Ski Mask Bandits, I don't know if you guys have heard of that, and Arnold Flicker, the leader of a group who had murdered a 77-year-old widow. So the leader of the group had paid 3 or 4 other people to murder the 77-year-old widow, and so he was sentenced to death. Usually, prosecutors cannot use a defendant's previous criminal records, patterns, or behaviors as evidence in a trial. But in Florida, they have this thing called the Williams Rule, which allows this in certain cases. If it is used to demonstrate motive, intent, modus operandi, knowledge or a lack of a mistake, and it's not abused just to prove bad character, then the judge may allow it. Now that's what they say, and they use this in Eileen's case, but I really just feel like it was used to prove bad character. Anyway, Judge Blount accepted the use of the Williams rule, which meant that her entire past, including the 6 additional murders that she would be on trial for, could all be brought up as evidence in court, because she first went to trial just for the murder of Richard Mallory, the one that they could conclusively confirm. So if you ever look at the court documents for Eileen Wuornos, it's all just about Richard Mallory and that case at first. The odds were stacked against her from the start, and that's an understatement. Prosecutors based most of their case on Wuornos' 4-hour videotaped confession to investigator Lawrence Horzepa during her initial interrogation on January 16, 1991 at the Volusia County Jail, which the defense failed to convince the circuit judge, Gail Graziano, not to release because it would damage the chances of a fair trial for her. As we go along, you will learn how much her defense team failed her. They literally should have said, no, that cannot actually be played in court because this will get our client a death sentence. But, you know, at the time they had no problem with it. Later, we'll read more now, but later they wanted to overturn that or be like, no, this can't be allowed now, but it was too late by then. And of course, the prosecution took full advantage of all of the mistakes that they made. That videotape helped to demonstrate the inconsistencies in her story, as well as the initial lack of descriptions of rape, malice, or violence of any kind from her victim, Richard Mallory. Because one would think, you know, if she did act in self-defense, and if she had been brutally raped like she later said she was, one would think that at that confession, you know, she would be telling the police that. But she didn't, and they used that against her in court. Unfortunately, at the time, Eileen was completely consumed with protecting her lover of 5 years, Tyria Moore, and based her entire confession on ensuring that she would not be incriminated as an accomplice in any of the crimes. The defense argued that Wuornos' relationship with Moore had been exploited to get an involuntary videotape confession out of her, which violated her rights to due process, even though they acknowledged that she had been read her Miranda rights and had legal advice from a public defender. It was said that Moore's ability to put Wuornos in an emotionally vulnerable state caused her to say anything that would help to keep her partner free from culpability in the crimes, which also affected her understanding of her rights or the consequences that she was facing. Even though her lawyer insisted that she say as little as possible to the police, she kept insisting, "I took a life, I'm willing to give up my life because I kill people. I deserve to die." She also said, "I'm a very kind person, but when I get drunk, I do stupid things. And if you're a hooker and you get somebody who starts messing with you, then you get angry." The defense filed a motion, you see here, to suppress the confession from being used in court. But of course, at that point, it was way too late. Not only because it was too late in the process, but also because the media already had it. And they were already negotiating movie deals and using it to create this huge reputation of this America's first female serial killer out there. So they couldn't retract that videotape at that point. Throughout the trial, Eileen was dressed neatly and did her best to look presentable with jailhouse resources. I don't know if you guys have ever watched these YouTubers that had spent time in prison, especially female prisons, and now that they're out, they make their whole channels about it, which I find very interesting, about what life was like in there, you know, what they ate, what they did, how they did their hair, how they did like makeshift mascara and things like that. There are 2 channels that I would recommend off the top of my head, which would be Jessica Kent and the other one is Christina Randall. I think I've actually recommended them to you guys before, but it's really, really interesting, especially to see the kind of snacks they made, or, you know, when they don't, obviously don't have like pizza in prison, you know, so they find ways to do it with like Graham's crackers or saltine crackers and all sorts of stuff like ramen noodle toppings and just all sorts of things. It's very interesting to watch if you ever did. So when I say that Eileen was using jailhouse resources, yeah, because I've watched those channels so much, I actually know what she was using. I can pretty much imagine how she got herself to look as presentable as she did, you know, at her trial. When she took the stand, she wore a blue blazer, a white collared shirt. I don't think she'd ever worn a collared shirt in her life before this day. A floral skirt. Can you imagine that? A floral skirt on Eileen Wuornos. And a gold necklace. If you want to see the actual footage of how she was dressed and how she was, you know, so well behaved on the day, you could just look on YouTube or on Court TV. They have all the footage there of this entire trial. And it's pretty interesting to see her like that, because before that she was very rough and tough as we know her. I mean, you might know her from the movie Monster if you haven't watched too much else about her. So it's like very ungroomed and, you know, just tired and just kind of brutal looking, you know. And here she was like a good little girl, you know what I mean? At first, she was questioned about her background and how she ended up in Florida and her relationship with Tyria. If you want to know all those details of exactly how she ended up in Florida, you know, what she did between the age of 15 and 20, because it took her like 5 years to settle in Florida. All of that is, of course, in the book. It's covered a lot in the psychology section. So again, I would recommend you get a copy if you want all the details. Later, she detailed the violent sexual assault and life-threatening circumstances that she found herself in with her victim, Richard Mallory. This was perceived as an inconsistency based on her leaving this information out when she confessed to the police on the videotape. While Mallory was known as a troubled eccentric whose electronics repair shop business was steeped in debt, which implied that he wouldn't have had afforded to pay for sexual favors at the time, the defense failed big time. They failed to source and present critical information about him, which they were heavily criticized for post-trial. He was a sex offender who had been sentenced to 10 years in prison for the assault and attempted rape of a woman in Maryland in 1957. What I found interesting about that fact is that it seems to literally have been attempted rape. So it was also attempted violent rape. So I don't know how violent he was, but the woman reported him and he was sentenced to prison. He had also paid for sex with a Tampa area woman, Chastity Marcus, who was actually initially the primary suspect in his murder, by rewarding her with a 19-inch color television and video cassette recorder on the same night that he had disappeared. So what does that mean? If it's on the same night, yes, he'd already been with prostitutes and Chastity was with a friend, which we find out, I think, a little bit later or in a later chapter. But he literally had sex with two women and then picked up Eileen after that for more, you know, so that's the kind of dude he was. Sadly, as grave an injustice as this was against Eileen's right to a fair trial, this was not the defense's only failure. They also failed to obtain reliable witnesses who had known Eileen throughout her life and could have presented valuable information in court simply, listen to this, by not rescheduling meetings that they were going to have with them, by not answering calls, and just not making the necessary arrangements to have them there. So Eileen had to defend herself. She literally didn't have childhood friends, or okay, she couldn't really rely on her family, as we'll see later, but they didn't call in anyone reliable to help her to testify. Even some of her clients, she said, could have really helped because she was in their good books. Her friends were aware of the incestuous abuse that Eileen was subjected to from her uncle and stepbrother, Barry Wuornos, and alcoholic grandfather, Laurie Wuornos, and prosecutors capitalized on the defense's failure to have those witnesses on the stand, instead getting Barry and his sister Laurie to tell the world how normal her childhood had been. I mean, of course, an abuser would want to take to the stand and say, no, man, everything was normal. Nothing wrong there. She was just a little bit naughty, but no abuse in the house. Had reliable witnesses been there to testify in Eileen's defense, including friends and obviously her regular clients, the likelihood of her getting sentenced to life instead of death was extremely high. So again, like the Gacy case and all these other cases, no one's saying that she was innocent. It's just that why sentence her to death six times over where she could have had life imprisonment, just like Dahmer, you know, Bundy, Gacy, all these people. Okay, Gacy was sentenced to death. He was executed. But you know what I mean. Why the death sentence? Well, because her defense massively failed her right from the start. So, of course, instead she had to defend herself and make use of her Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination 25 times to complete her story relating to the murder of Richard Mallory. Prosecutors cunningly convinced the jury that Mallory had no previous criminal record, even adding, "For 20 years he led a normal, uneventful life. What happened that far back is irrelevant." But yet they applied the Williams rule to use as much evidence as possible from her past to build a case against her and debunk her claims of self-defense. So that was very unfair. I think that's also why a lot of people empathize with Eileen Wuornos, is that she really had a very unfair trial. I think if she was sentenced to life imprisonment and she just stayed there, I think we'd have less sympathy on her. Am I right? You know, but I think the injustice of these cases and these trials, it was just ridiculous. And here's where it really gets sad for her. Prosecutors had Tyria Moore on their side, who threw Eileen under the bus without hesitation to protect her own freedom, which was devastating to watch. She answered all the questions presented to her as best she could, but smirked, known in body language references as duping delight, as she told the court about the conversation that she had with Eileen regarding Mallory's death. If you want to know more about duping delight, I would highly recommend the YouTube channel Derek Van Schaik. He is, in my opinion, the best at analyzing body language. He's qualified for it, well overqualified. So if you want to check that out, he's on YouTube, he's on Instagram and everywhere else. I'll link that below as well for you guys. I'm not at all affiliated with him or sponsored or anything like that. It's just, I just love the channel. I think I have also recommended him to you in the past. So here's what Tyria said. "We were sitting on the floor watching TV and she just come out and say, 'I have something to tell you,' and asked her what, and she said that she had shot and killed a man that day. If you do go and watch the footage of her, you'll know, you'll hear by my tone that I've listened to that a lot of times. Like, I've watched that court footage so many times, I could practically recite it at this point." The prosecutor asked, "Did you say anything when she told you?" She answered, "No, I didn't want to believe it. I was probably in awe." Now, I sat on that sentence for a long time because I really pay attention to communication. I hang on every word that people say. And yeah, I'm one of those that's kind of, I think that's a true crime thing, isn't it? Kind of got the microscope on everyone. I don't mean to do that, but I can't help it. I've always been very passionate about communication. And when she said, "I was probably in awe," I literally watched that over and over and I just looked at her face. I looked at how she said it and I think she really meant in awe. She didn't say in shock. She didn't say, "Yeah, no, I was in total disbelief." She said, "I was probably in awe." I think there's a possibility that she meant exactly what she said. Perhaps she had admired Eileen for her crimes, but needed to save herself from the consequences of it. I mean, maybe, we don't know how she felt about men or not, but maybe she was a bit of a man-hater and maybe she admired what Eileen was doing, wiping out these like abusive, perverted men in their view, you know? I'm saying like that because I got to kind of be careful how I say it because, yeah, the focus is always to rehumanize the victims. I definitely think that some of these men, you know, that Eileen killed, were possibly a little bit perverted or, you know, made requests that pissed her off or whatever, but they definitely didn't deserve to die. You know, that's a overreaction on Eileen's part. But when I think about this relationship and I think of Tyria saying, "I was probably in awe," I was just amazed that that's what she chose to say in court. Like, what? You're going to tell everyone that you were in awe of her and you're going to have that little smirk at the same time? Man. Anyway, the entire time through her testimony and being on the stand, she didn't look at Eileen, not once. She distanced herself completely to maintain her stone-cold face during questioning. Eileen was heartbroken and cried in her hands as prosecutors played the recordings of the phone calls that had convinced her to confess. She had been through the worst in life, but had never felt so betrayed. That's what she said. She had never felt as betrayed as she did on that day. Not only did Tyria sell her out in court, which ultimately sealed her fate, but Tyria was also later exposed for signing rights to movies and books with a band of corrupt police officers. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll look at her sentencing for the Richard Mallory trial, but then also for the other trials. I'll be with you now. On January 27th, 1992, after just 2 hours of deliberation, the jury found Eileen Wuornos guilty of all charges, including armed robbery. On January 28, 1992, the trial entered its penalty phase with the same jury who would decide between life and death as punishment for the murder of Richard Mallory. Psychiatrists and psychologists presented their case to the jury, unanimous in their diagnosis of Eileen having borderline personality disorder. The state's expert psychologist, Dr. Bernard, testified that Wuornos suffered from borderline personality disorder, BPD, and antisocial personality disorder, ASPD, but that her impairment was not substantial and her disturbance was not extreme, even though she may have experienced mental deterioration at the time of her crimes. He also expressed that her alcoholism, upbringing, which is obviously including genetic and environmental deficits, and mental challenges, including an IQ of 81, provided non-statutory mitigating evidence. Three defense psychologists testified that Eileen suffered from borderline personality disorder and would have gone through extreme emotional and psychological disturbance at the time of her crimes. So as you can see, as with all cases, especially in crime, the psychologists and psychiatrists kind of agreed but also disagreed at the same time. You know, while one was saying it wouldn't have caused her significant emotional stress at the time, others say it would have caused her significant and extreme emotional and psychological disturbance. One psychologist said that the details of her stories shifting and changing was not her intentionally lying, but was a symptom of her mental illness. Her childhood was summarized as traumatic, and her life was portrayed as being the victim of extreme violence, betrayal, and abuse, which may have resulted in her lashing out at one of her victimizers, Richard Mallory. When Eileen's IQ and maturity were brought up by psychologists, she actually sat there giggling, which her defense attorneys used as evidence of her distorted and immature view of the world. Tricia Jenkins said that Eileen was a damaged and primitive child who should not be put to death for her crimes, but rather be sentenced to life behind bars. I thought about that long and hard, you know, and even this IQ thing. I wanted to know, when did they measure that? And I found out that they did not do an IQ test on her at the time, but based her IQ on her performance at school in junior high. I mean, she dropped out of school already at age 15. So, and before that, she was suffering from a lot of abuse and things. So I can't believe that that's, you know, what they pinned her IQ at. She's one of the lower ranked serial killers, you know, of all of them. So I don't know. I just found that that was a little bit misrepresented in that way. But also to say that she's this damaged and primitive child, where she was actually a hitchhiking hooker who murdered a whole bunch of men. Like, to me, it just doesn't go with this whole, like, oh, she's so immature, she's like a little girl, like a little high school girl or little girl, I don't know. It just didn't go for me, you know, I don't know. Let me know what you think, but I definitely don't think that Eileen was on the low side of IQ, and I don't think that she, you know, was as immature and childlike as people made her out to be. I mean, I understand why the defense would go that way, but I think in reality she wasn't exactly childlike. She was doing very adult things for money, and no, that doesn't mean now she's mature. I just wouldn't put her in the category of being like childlike. Am I now disagreeing with a psychologist and psychiatrist? Of course not. I'm not a mental health professional by any means. It's just, obviously in the book, I do not share any of my opinion. And here on this podcast, that's kind of the reason I do the podcast, is so that I can just expand on some of the things that I thought and felt while writing the book and maybe start some conversations. The jury considered all aggravating factors, which included a previous criminal record based on violence, the robbery of her victim, murder to avoid arrest, murder that was particularly cruel, cold, and premeditated, as well as the one mitigating factor was that she was diagnosed with BPD. Her childhood, physical abuse, the fact that her father and grandfather committed suicide, her incestuous relationship with her brother, who died in 1976 at the age of 21, her grandmother's death from the consequences of alcoholism, her teenage pregnancy, and her mother abandoning her at a young age were all taken into consideration. The jury unanimously concluded, in a vote of 12 to none, that despite all these difficulties, Eileen still knew right from wrong at the time of her crimes and should be sentenced to death. Before she was sentenced, her adoptive mother, whose name was Arlene Prawley, decided to make a statement. That was on November the 6th, 1991, where she pleaded for mercy for her daughter's life, saying that she never had a chance to receive the treatment that she had always needed for her disorder, something that she offered to pay for if they spared her life. If you ever do grab yourself a copy of this book, you will find out that Arlene herself was no angel. I mean, I'm sure we'll touch on it in the upcoming episodes, but yeah, here she was just sounding so sweet and in Eileen's best interests, but that wasn't really the case. Eileen dressed neatly in a pink turtleneck with a gold necklace and her hands clasped together, was allowed the opportunity to make a brief comment to the judge. So I paid attention, obviously, to what she was wearing because I just found it so fascinating compared to how she was out on the streets and how she was in court. You know, it's almost like she was dressed for church, if you know what I mean. Like she was there with a little pink turtleneck. I mean, she didn't wear pink before, not from any of the other photos I've seen of her ever or anything she said or how she dressed and was. It's just kind of funny to be this whole other person, which we see happen sometimes. I'm sure you're familiar with the Jodi Arias case. I mean, did you see how much she changed her appearance from, you know, before she was caught and then after? And how she had the glasses on in the courtroom and just wanted to look sort of like a librarian then, you know? So it's kind of like that. That's what I mean. So she said, first of all, I'd like to say that I have been labeled a serial killer and I am no serial killer. I have been framed by law enforcement as a serial killer because of numerous men involved, but what I was a prostitute, and in my prostitution, I happened to deal with a lot of men, at least 250 a month, and I ran into these men along the way in my prostitution. Look, at least here she said 250 a month. You'll find that later she said she slept with about, you know, 250,000 people, which is just not possible when you do the math. She said, I do not feel I was not out there to hurt anyone. I had no intentions of hurting anyone. In my confessions, I stated that 9 times. I stated 37 times self-defense. 39 times that they raped or beat and then began to rape and had intentions of killing. And what I did is what anybody else would do. I defended myself, which everybody has the right to defend themselves. And I had no intentions of killing anyone. I would not do that. I'm not that type of person. Anyway, what I'm trying to say here is that while I've been through these 2.5 weeks in the courtroom, I told you that I was raped and that is what happened. And that is what happened with all the other cases that I'll be involved in and discussing. And these people did a violent attack on me. And I did what I had to do. Sorry, I didn't mean to giggle. It just sounds funny the way she said it like that. And these people did a violent attack on me. And I did what I had to do to protect myself. Now, I'd like to point out one other thing is that law enforcement has framed me as a serial killer purposely for books and movies. So already there in those early days, she started with a whole conspiracy theory. you know, which later, as we saw, I'm guessing you saw it. Have you ever seen the footage of her final death row interviews, where she's talking about sonic pressure and all those big conspiracy theories? Yeah, it already started here. I thought for a while as well why she would have, you know, said that. Like, it's easy enough to giggle along and be like, oh my word, what is she on about? Or to maybe even speculate with her and think, well, let's think about that for a second. Like, would that be possible? Obviously, it sounds quite ridiculous to think that cops, you know, that's the thing that Nick Broomfield asked her, but why would the cops frame you for murder or just let you kill? Not everyone is out there just like killing people and them just watching by and letting them do it. You know what I mean? So that seems quite ridiculous. But I think the reason that she had all these conspiracy theories is because she was struggling with a bit of psychosis, which means being out of touch with reality, where really everyone that she ever thought she could trust betrayed her, especially Tyria Moore. And from that day, when she found out just these little nuggets of information, you know, that she felt she's now onto something. So instead of just being like, well, the person I thought was my partner and my girlfriend and lover betrayed me, no, it became this huge conspiracy theory where the entire world was against her, which is actually something that's quite common in patients who struggle with BPD. You know, it's that very black or white, in or out thinking. And I must say, I relate to it. I think you guys have known, I've said it before in a previous season, that I was initially diagnosed with dissociative identity disorder because of all the trauma that I've suffered from in my life. You know, trauma causes things in the mind that can cause the mind to fracture. And I don't open up too much about all my traumas. I don't really find it too relevant here, but here and there I'll touch on it. But just to fast forward, now that I've been living here in the Netherlands for 2 years, I've kind of been on an adventure, shall we call it, where I have been to a psychiatric and psychological clinic here. And I was initially assigned there because I was going to be treated for DID. But it turns out that I have more in common with the diagnosis of BPD, which kind of makes sense to me because I relate to all of those symptoms. And it's driven by this massive fear of abandonment, which we'll see throughout Eileen's book. So I must say, when I wrote this book, oh man, there were some times when I'm like, well, I know how she would have felt. Like, I really literally know how she would have felt in that moment. And yeah, that panic can make you do some weird things. But obviously, she took it to the highest level. Just a disclaimer that no matter what mental illness anyone has, it's never an excuse to harm others. Not even to harm yourself, but especially not to harm others or take someone else's life. I really believe in seeking therapy and treatment and getting the help that you need. And I would pretty much encourage everyone to go to therapy because it's helpful no matter what. Whether you have a mental illness or not, I think it's very, very valuable. But especially if you suspect that you do or you struggle with something, I think it would really help. Anyway, just to sort of finish off what I was alluding to there, I'm kind of waiting to join a program here and then I'll be formally diagnosed, whether it's DID or BPD or whatever. You know, the label doesn't bother me so much anymore because I can see even in these cases, you'll see, remember with John Wayne Gacy's case, how many different diagnoses he had? They were like, no, he's a paranoid schizophrenic. No, he's got BPD. No, he's got ASPD. No, he's got all of those things. But like, okay, could we maybe just agree on something? Or as a psychiatrist here told me, just focus on your symptoms and let's work on that and help you have a better quality of life. And that's what's important. So yeah, I agree with that. Anyway, the whole point of bringing all that up was just to say that I really relate to Eileen's BPD and some of the ways that she behaved, but it just got so out of control for her, man. It just escalated and escalated. It was like a huge friggin' snowball effect for her. Okay, moving on. On January 31st, 1992, Judge Blount Jr. sentenced Eileen to 10 years for the armed robbery charges, plus death by electrocution for the premeditated first-degree murder of Richard Mallory. He said, now this was harsh, listen to what he said. By warrant of the governor of the state of Florida, you, Eileen Carol Wuornos, be electrocuted until you are dead. May God have mercy on your corpse. That was a very harsh thing to say, because normally people would say, may God have mercy on your soul. That would be the normal thing, appropriate thing to say. But he said, may God have mercy on your corpse. Like completely invalidating her soul and her as a person. No, may he just have mercy on your corpse. That was just a very strange and cold thing to say. I'm not saying be warm and friendly to a serial killer. I'm just kind of pointing out that that was, I haven't really heard that one before. When she was escorted out of the Florida Supreme Courtroom and into a van to be transferred to death row, she yelled out to the media, bust these crooked cops and their conspiracy, please, I'm innocent. She looked defeated, traumatized, and lost, which was unlike her usual head-tossing, finger-flipping self. Now, I almost wrote there that she looked like a drowned kitten, but that's just like really not a nice thing to say. It's kind of harsh words, but I mean, she literally looked like a cat that had been standing in the rain all day. I don't know. If you've seen that footage, you know what I'm talking about. Of course, after this trial, Eileen was driven to the Florida Department of Corrections, Broward Correctional Institution, which is BCI. We heard her talk about BCI in the final footage of her on death row. It was a maximum security death row facility for women, approximately 471 miles away. I'm not too sure how she was transferred there, if she was driven there or like, you know, if they took a helicopter, but that's a fair distance to cover, you know, and then to think that she had to kind of go back and forth for all these other trials because she was still facing charges for, so this was the one murder, which was Richard Mallory. She had 7 victims, but one body was never found, which was of her final victim. So either way, she still had to face 5 different trials and she hated it. Once she knew that she was sentenced to death, it was kind of like, ugh, whatever. Let's just move on with it and get this done and just get me into the execution chamber as fast as possible. That's pretty much all she said on death row throughout that entire time, which I guess is another reason that people sympathize or empathize with Eileen, is that her death was almost at that point kind of like an assisted suicide. I mean, yes, she was sentenced to death. It was the law. She got executed for her crimes. But because she so badly wanted to die, it just added this like sad element to it. Anyway, when I started this episode, I hadn't realized that all the other trials are still pages and pages worth of information, which I cover in the death row chapter. So I will do that in the next episode so that we can look at all of that, because that is also where it got really messy. I mean, her first trial was a giant mess, but so were the others. So we will look at that in the next episode. I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. I will see you for episode 3. We'll look at her time on death row and all those other trials and sentences. Thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate each and every listener. If you haven't yet, please click the follow button or subscribe or whatever you can click. And if you would be so kind as to leave your review on Podchaser or Apple, I would greatly appreciate it. It really, really helps a small independent podcast to grow. Thank you also to each person who's already bought their copy of the book. Or any of the books that I've written. And thank you so much to everyone who's bought me a cup of coffee. That really does go a long way. I really, really appreciate it. I do hope that you will go and check out the merch. I think that's what you guys would like the most, like more than the bookmarks and all the other things I make. I think the merch is something that I'm almost the proudest of out of the things I do beyond, you know, writing and publishing the books. It's obviously a shit ton of work to make the books available in all these formats, ebook, paperback, and audiobook, but I want it to be that way so that you can get whatever version you prefer the most. You know, people have their preferences and I want to provide the value that way and really get these victims' stories out, really understand, you know, these killers for what they were, and not at all to sensationalize them, romanticize them, glorify them, or anything like that. Okay, I think I've rambled on enough for the day. I hope that you enjoyed it, and I will see you in the next one. Stay safe.